Moss, ma'am.
I open the Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood. It is May 5th. Senator Roblin pointed out that yesterday it was May the 4th be with you, and today is the return of the 5th.
Huh?
It's a Star Wars thing. It's a movie.
Oh, I love Star Wars.
Okay, I am going to open up a hearing on House Bill 3082 and invite Representative Frederick. And Shane, could you give us a brief description of the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3082 provides alternate definition of low income for purposes of property tax abatement for nonprofit corporations related to housing, directs governing bodies to designate use of standard or alternative definition of low income, allows governing bodies to change currently adopted definition of low income, takes effect the 91st day after signing die and sunsets June 30th, 2027. This has a minimal revenue impact, no fiscal, no subsequent referral. Came out of House Committee 6-9 and off the House floor unanimously.
What do you mean it came off 6-9? How many members are on that committee?
I'm sorry,
6-3.
Six zero. And
okay. So sorry, Madam Chair, really members. Really big committee.
6-0, nay, 3 excused.
Got it.
The House
All
committee.
Right.
My apologies.
Thank you
that's
very
not
much.
Up to 9, though, so that's okay.
That's a lot of members.
Well, they do crazy things over there in the House.
No.
My fault.
That's what we say about you folks.
Welcome, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Representative. I'm Chair Gelser and members of the committee. I am Representative Frederick, Lou Frederick, from House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. House Bill 3082 will sound confusing. It's actually very simple. So I just want to give you that as a caveat. Officially, it revises the nonprofit low-income housing property tax exemption by creating an additional option under which local jurisdictions can provide a nonprofit housing property tax exemption that is consistent with the jurisdiction's affordable housing goals. I know that's a little hard to follow, but I'm going to try my best to explain. Currently, when a family qualifies by income when they first move into low-income housing administered by a nonprofit organization under the exemption, but their income stabilizes and it rises to just $1 over 60% of the area median income in Portland. In Portland, that's $44,100 for a family of four. Their housing no longer qualifies for the exemption, and the nonprofit receives a property tax bill. At the same time, on their way up from poverty, this income level does not immediately enable them to move into market rate housing. So hardworking families can be pushed over this cliff just as they're pulling themselves up and out of poverty. The option created by House Bill 3082 would provide stability for families whose income rises slightly during their tenancy. It provides them an opportunity for a smooth transition rather than a cliff as they work towards home ownership or private market housing. The bill allows local jurisdictions that adopt the exemption under the statute that is newly adopted to choose either 60% area median income cap or to allow the income of existing residents to rise above 60% but no higher than 80% of AMI. And that 80% of AMI in Portland is $58,800 for a family of four. It allows, but it does not require local jurisdictions already using the exemption under ORS 307.540 to choose to allow income of existing residents to arise above 60% but no higher than 80% of AMI. It requires reauthorization or sunset of the statute by June 30th, 2027. In Portland and in Washington County and Lincoln County, the program is used by nonprofits to keep rents affordable for thousands of low-income households. In my district, the Portland Community Reinvestments Initiative, PCRI, has reinvested in Portland's neighborhoods for over 22 years, preserved their diversity, and provided tools to help low-income families and individuals achieve a stability and self-sufficiency. PCRI's unique mix of 700 rentals that utilize the tax exemption program include single-family rental homes, small multiplexes, and community apartments that are woven into the fabric of North and Northeast Portland. These help eliminate concentrations of poverty and represent one of the last stable opportunities for low-income households, particularly African Americans, to remain in their historic neighborhoods. PCRI assists renters to become home buyers, including providing home buying classes, helping them strengthen their credit, assisting with pre-qualification process for home loans, and assisting the search for a home. Affordable rents allow household income and expenses to stabilize and enable families to save for down payments with matched savings programs. House Bill 3082 removes the barrier to PCRI and other nonprofits serving low-income Oregonians with affordable rent and self-sufficiency programs that support their transition out of poverty. In addition to Portland and Multnomah County, Washington and Lincoln counties, metro and community-based organizations, including the Urban League, the Living Cully Coalition, and the Oregon Opportunity Network, provided testimony in support of House Bill 3082. And as was mentioned, House Bill 3082 passed out of the House Human Services and Housing Committee without opposition and the House floor with only one dissenting vote. I urge you to pass it on to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Representative Frederick?
Yes, first off, I almost think you're stalking me, but I'm not quite sure about that.
I am.
Okay. I was wondering, Representative, if you might consider an amendment to get rid of the cliffs and all the federal programs as well.
I have so much power over the federal programs.
Madam Chair, it's just, I mean, this is symptomatic of something system-wide that needs to be addressed, and I wish Congress would pay attention to it.
Senator Gelser, Senator Cruz, I understand and I would wish Congress would pay attention to this as well. This PCRI has been very clear about how this will help an incredible number of folks in my neighborhood and my community and across the state for that matter.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thanks for bringing us this bill.
You're going to hear from Senator Shields here about this as well. So, good. Thank you.
So I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3082 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2219A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2219A directs the Department of Human Services to convene a work group to examine consolidating applications for services. It requires a report to the legislature by September 15th, 2016. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There is an A2 amendment that adds ODOT and transportation issues to that work group to be convened. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal on that A2. This is also unanimous out of House Committee and the House floor.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from House District 13. Oregonians who need some help are jumping through hoops, and sometimes the same hoops over and over again, filling out forms with the same information over and over again to receive services that they need and are eligible for. Most low-income Oregonians in need of services are eligible for multiple types of assistance. For example, perhaps SNAP and WIC, or the Oregon Health Plan, maybe employment-related daycare or low-income home energy assistance, weatherization assistance, job training, employment services, TANF, domestic violence survivors, school-based breakfast and lunch, state children's health insurance, Oregon Summer Food Service, etc. There are Oregonians receiving more than one type of help, and many times they have filled out separate forms to be processed for each one of those. Within just the Department of Human Services, more than half of the adults participate in two or more programs. When it comes to kids, less than a quarter of kids receive only one program. Here are examples of some of the forms that we have found.
Do you have them?
Oh, they're in the office. I'm sorry. We have examples that I can provide you. But on those examples, we have lots of the same questions on each one.
She's showing them. She does have them.
Oh, you do. Thank you.
Nice PowerPoint.
And so as you flip through, you'll see some highlighted information on each of these forms. It won't surprise you to know we ask for name, address, social security number, birth date, sex, email address, phone number, race, ethnicity, information on each member of the household, monthly rent and utilities, all income sources, and employment and other benefits for each member of the household. Also, there are some questions, such as whether anyone in the household is pregnant, is enrolled in school, and on and on. The point being, though, that on some of these forms, the same question is the same over and over and over again, and usually from one day to the next, one week to the next, you generally have the same number of children, the same address, the same birth date, and so on. There should be an easier way for Oregonians to apply for all of the services they're eligible for. This bill directs the Department of Human Services to convene a work group along with other agencies covering housing, employment, education, and child care, and the state's chief information officer, specializing in information technology and data collection, for example, to study how to create a consolidated application process. Of course, each program will need to review the application since the eligibility criteria for each program might vary somewhat. We recognize that. And from one agency to another, they might need to ask an additional question or two. But what about all those base questions that stay the same time after time? Some other states have been able to achieve this simplification, like Pennsylvania and Washington. And there are a few examples of local agencies here in Oregon that have achieved some simplification, like a single application for more than one local program. After an initial assessment, a provider may ask a few additional questions, but not start from scratch. There's also the use of the concept called preemptive eligibility. That means if you've already qualified for one program, you are presumed to qualify for another, and the data has already been verified. The federal government even allows this kind of process, preemptive eligibility, for certain programs like energy assistance. Scarce resources then can be moved from intake to direct services or case management. The alternative is what people go through now, repeating the name, address, family, employment, birth date, etc., over and over. A consolidated application will help both the Oregonians applying for assistance and the agencies and organizations that are working to help them. We should spend more time helping people and less time filling out and reviewing forms. The agencies that help will no longer each have to spend time and money having employees individually audit the information that was submitted, repeating each other's work that was just done the previous day, the previous week, the previous month. The other states have succeeded in making this idea work. Pennsylvania's has won awards for the online application process called Compass that allows individuals to submit and track their application all in one place. Instead of filling out multiple forms, an individual can apply for various things like health care coverage, children's health insurance, and medical assistance for workers with disabilities, SNAP, cash assistance, long-term care, home and community-based services for individuals with intellectual disabilities, low-income home energy assistance, free and reduced-price school meals, and child care, all at once, all in one place. And that's Pennsylvania that's figured out how to make that happen. Oregon, too, can make a consolidated application process work as well. I hope you will support this effort, which starts the conversation. We don't have the solution, but we should start the conversation. And I am aware that you have an amendment that would add transportation, and specifically Oregon Department of Transportation, to the list of agencies that should be convened. I understand the sentiment behind that. Transportation is often a service that people need help with. I'm not aware, however, that ODOT itself has any forms that where they, as a department, are asking people to submit forms to qualify for assistance. So I just wanted to let you know that. But thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative, or how about you?
Thank you, Chair. A lot of this just comes down to IT, and we are not known in Oregon to be very good with our IT programs, and so I am hoping that this committee will look at that. But I know there are other bills out there addressing IT, and of course, when you start wanting Oregon Health Plan, we have and maybe even public health and clinics, et cetera, there are the confidentiality issues, and every agency says, well, there's confidentiality issues. That's why we have to have a separate form. So hopefully the committee will be productive. It would help.
Madam Chair, yes. And Senator Mona Sanderson, I agree with the sentiment of your comments. Absolutely. Information technology has taken on a large part of the conversation in this building for more than a couple of years now. And I'm pleased that you have pointed out in the public hearing today that there are other bills working their way through the legislature this year to address IT more generally. There are bills, for example, that impact contracting generally to add oversight responsibilities. There's a bill that addresses the role of the state's chief information officer, where that officer should be located, what the responsibilities and duties are, and how effective that that person can be under a new type of authority and role that office hasn't had in the past. Agencies have largely been autonomous, and despite advice that they may have received, or more likely not seeking advice from other agencies or a Department of Administrative Services, agencies will be now under more oversight and more coordination than they have in the past if the bills are passed by both chambers and signed by the governor. So I have some confidence that Oregon is on the right path toward increased oversight and better outcomes in information technology.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Dembrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I love what you're doing here with this representative. And I'm wondering, so in the narrowest sense, what this bill is setting up is a work group to come up with a common form. And you're calling on it to complete its work by the middle of September of 2016, which leads me to think that you're thinking that there may be some legislative action that may need to be taken. And I'm wondering, are you thinking that this group will, by that September date, come up with the form as well as some of the implementation challenges or, you know, some of those issues kind of related to what Senator Mona Sanderson was saying that would need to be addressed in the legislature, and then that would be taken up by the committees between September and the session? You know, I'm just wondering when the legislative fixes will start to be developed.
Madam Chair and Senator Dembrough, indeed, I think this is going to take a while. As you all have recognized, this is not only about state agencies, but there are local agencies that then use information or do referrals that would be involved. I believe that 211, for example, would also have an interest in participating in the conversations because 211 does referrals to many different agencies and understands the challenges of application and eligibility and receiving and delivering services in an efficient and an appropriate way. Yes, I think it is possible that there will be legislative fixes that will need to happen in addition to a single form. It may be that departments need to come up with new administrative rules about approvals for changes in forms or who they work with, what groups of stakeholders they work with, for example. The conversation is wide open at this point. I would like, though, to keep our eyes on what we want an outcome to be rather than a work group that comes back and tells us, well, we just couldn't figure it out. There's no way to do it. I don't think that would be an appropriate response. Obviously, it can be done. Other states have taken steps to do this. We can figure it out as well. I also think that in a time where it's well known in databases how when you can segregate information into discrete pieces and then through a system of permissions and logins and various special flags and settings, you can allow access to only certain information, not others. I think we can satisfactorily resolve issues or concerns around confidentiality or privacy where certain types of information can be known and shared, and those pieces that have to be held private can be held private with access for only one agency or two agencies that have that particular permission. So I don't think that's an excuse either for not being able to do this.
Thank you. Senator Cruz and then Senator Olson.
Thank you. First, Representative, I would say your comment about agencies and autonomy when it comes to IT, I would say incompetence would be a better term. But I was wondering, do we know where the amendment on transportation comes from?
Yes. This comes from, pull this back up, a gentleman named Mark Vollmert, and the concern, I just pulled this back up and put it back away. He says, for many people, particularly those who live in small cities or rural areas, a lack of adequate transportation is a significant barrier to accessing human services. And then again, today I heard from him, and he said, as a reminder, for nearly a decade, every county transit district has been required by federal and state law to develop a coordinated public transit human services transportation plan. This is a clear recognition of the important role that transportation plays in developing and delivering human services. But even though Oregon spends $344 million a biennium on transportation, the state does not have a coordinated plan. House Bill 2219A is a small but important step in linking transportation to the development and delivery of human services by state agencies.
Madam Chair, I fully recognize the issue. I just don't think the Department of Transportation is where those services are delivered. I guess my thought was, because the bill does allow this group to call on anybody they want to at any point in time, that I would suggest that transportation will be an issue they will look at, but I'm not sure that adding the Department of Transportation would necessarily be helpful. Just a thought.
That was a question I had. I noticed a little consternation in your voice when you talked about the Department of Transportation. I am certainly concerned about it, in that we just did motor voter, and the possibility of intermingling records could exist because of the problems we have with our computer system. So I was just, the question I have is, do you think that this amendment is appropriate for your bill? I like your bill. Your bill is awesome. But do you think this adding the Department of Transportation would be appropriate for this bill, whereas you have the ability to call these people in for discussion?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, as Senator Cruz has pointed out, there is an allowance in the bill for including others in the conversation as other services or other agencies are identified that do have forms that could be consolidated. Since the focus of this is creating a more consolidated application process, I am not aware of any forms that the Department of Transportation has. I think the sentiment of the statement that we heard from the chair about the need for planning for transportation services and access to transportation to be able to get access to other human services or medical services, that's an issue, but I think it's separate from the purpose of this particular bill. I think it damages the intent of the bill. I just don't think at this time it's a necessary part of the bill.
Madam Chair, I'd also say I think we find in most communities that the transportation network, the buses and things like that, are not in the Department of Transportation. They're in other other more relevant agencies. So that's why I think it's probably, I think the issues will be addressed, but I'm not sure adding the department as a standalone agency on the list is probably the right thing to do.
Right. I think the concern that he has raised is he has expressed repeatedly concerns that the Department of Transportation, Special Transportation, County Transportation programs are not appropriately coordinated with Human Services, and that there are more efficient ways to spend funds that we currently have that would get more people transported to more places. So I believe he's looking for places where there is this discussion of coordination and streamlining, and wanting to be sure that transportation is part of that discussion.
Madam Chair, but I would suggest that those funds that do flow in the Department of Transportation are passed through down to the local level. The department does not make those decisions.
Well, I might as well throw some stuff into the hat, too. I sometimes on my task force like to designate who is at the table, because if they aren't designated to be at the table, they aren't going to show up and be a part of the ongoing process. I think you'll just have to make that decision. But, if I certainly don't want to have Department of Transportation to be there if they really don't have a role. But sometimes it's just nice to put in the bill that transportation will be a part of what we would be looking at.
Well, I had not realized that he had not had a conversation with you, so we will not move the bill today. I will make sure that connection gets made. Clearly, we're going to move this bill and figure out what to do with that. Thank you all very much. And with that, let's go ahead and finish up this bill. We actually have a number of bills to get through, so I'm going to ask people to be relatively brief. The next panel is going to be Stacey Cowan, Ryan Fisher, and Elizabeth Rimley. Or just Ryan Fisher.
Elizabeth let me know that she had to run out, and so she will be back shortly if she is able. I'll be very brief. My name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here today on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, here in support of this bill. I have submitted some written testimony from the Community Action Director in Central Oregon, and I think he gives a very good and graphic description of some of the duplication that occurs with the systems that we currently have right now. Community Action agencies allocate funding from federal sources, from state sources, from private sources, and so they are literally putting together a patchwork of funding, and this is a big issue that they face, and it takes up a lot of their time. There was some discussion about the IT-related issues, and I would refer you to Senate Bill 670, which has been introduced by Senator Steiner Hayward, which is designed to look specifically at this issue of how do we figure out who can share which information. Her task force during the interim discovered that a lot of times it's sort of the equivalent of urban legend, whether or not you can share something, and that people always err to the side of caution for understandable reasons. And so perhaps these two in tandem can really provide some excellent recommendations for the legislature. And so we are in strong support. Thank you.
Thank you. Elizabeth.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, Elizabeth Rimley here today on behalf of Shelter Care, which is a Lane County Housing and Human Services provider. We're here to support House Bill 2219, and we appreciate Rep. Nathanson keeping us in the loop on this bill. Susan Bann couldn't be here today. She's the executive director. Shelter Care consolidated its internal applications at Shelter Care for the same reasons that House Bill 2219 is looking at consolidating state applications. We're dealing with folks who experience all kinds of barriers in their normal lives, and the last thing they need is a paperwork barrier to get services that they need. So we're glad glad that we're going to have this discussion. We're glad that we can be helpful in doing that. And we hope that we get to a place where we can actually have this consolidated application. I think of it a little bit like the Common App for universities. If anybody's had a child that's applied to college in the last couple of years, most of the schools are signed up to have one baseline Common App, and then each school can ask for additional questions or credentials for their school, and it works out really well. It saves everybody a ton of time, and I think that if we can get anywhere close to doing that for our vulnerable populations, we'll be a lot better off as a state. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel?
Any question?
Senator Olson?
Yes, we just talked about an amendment adding the Department of Transportation. Is that relevant to what your people, do you need to have the Department of Transportation fill out forms for them or anything like that?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, I don't think that Shelter Care has an opinion one way or the other about whether ODOT is included in this work group. I don't think that it would impact us in any major way, but I would have to ask Shelter Care before I give you a final answer on that.
Follow up? Basically, I guess my question was, do you need to have an application form for ODOT for your people that
Chair
they need
Gelser,
to fill out?
Senator Olson, I actually don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Thank
Sorry.
You.
Great. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you so much. Next, we have John Mullen, Philip Evans, and Patty Whitney Wise.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I would just mention very briefly that this has been a perennial issue. I've been around for a long, long time, and when I ran Clackamas County Social Services with 65 different funding sources, oftentimes funding sources wanted information in particular ways. So I agree that having this kind of a discussion about ways to look at streamlining, simplifying, and particularly when we talk about this from a client perspective, that's really important, but it also is a benefit to staff when things can be streamlined. We did have a lost opportunity with the problems that happened with technology because the Department of Human Services was looking to upgrade its systems and do a modernization approach to getting really to the no wrong door kind of idea of working both with the Oregon Housing Authority and other entities. But I would just submit it's not just a technology issue, and hopefully getting the right people around the table will make sense. And if we can't revise a number of things from the past, we can at least make an attempt going forward about how application processes would work in the future. So I know that a number of us would be happy to participate in this discussion. And if I may, just to add a little quick comment about the Department of Transportation, whatever it is you decide to do, one of the roles that we had in Clackamas County was creating a transportation system for paratransit for people who are seniors and people with disabilities. And just as Senator Cruz mentioned, really ODOT was really one of our funding sources and not on the front end of determining applications or how information even got gathered for that matter. So we just submit that it's probably possible to get information from people who are on the ground about transportation issues about how to make this work better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. Patty Whitney Wise with Partners for Hunger Free Oregon and the Oregon Hunger Task Force. We're in support of this bill and for a couple of different reasons, all the things that have been mentioned. In addition, we've been approached by a national funder to coordinate with about four other nonprofits to look at how we can increase access to certain programs where people are underserved. So an example of that is when Medicaid became available to more people, the Department of Human Services fast-tracked the SNAP clients because they were categorically eligible. It doesn't happen the other way around, though, and so there are areas where that kind of categorical eligibility and helping people actually qualify for more than one program without ever having to fill out another piece of paper are possible, and we're looking forward to working with this committee on making that happen more in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much. Any questions for Patty? Thank you both very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2219, reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3082, and invite Val Frey, John Miller, and Maxine Fitzpatrick, please. Welcome.
Thank you.
You want me to?
Okay. Sorry, my just one moment, please. While my application wakes up. I'm sorry. Just one moment. I left it on my chair. I'll go grab my paper copy.
All right. Well, maybe we can start with another panelist while you're. Feel free to go get the pieces of paper.
Oh, strange. Here. Just had it.
There it goes. All right.
Oh, that's the wrong one. Thank you. Sorry. Excuse me. They want me to go first, so let me go grab it.
That's okay. Yeah, that's
right. Technology.
Yeah, that's what we're just talking about.
So my apologies for the delay. I'm John Miller. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Opportunity Network. The reason I was waiting for my computer, Representative Frederick actually said many of the points that I was going to make, and so I actually changed my testimony on the fly and did not want to repeat some of the things that he said. But I'll go ahead and since I'm having technical difficulties, I'll just work through this really quickly. So we know that access to safe, decent, affordable housing provides the stability required for long-term success. Families who have stability in their homes are healthier. They contribute to local economies, and they're able to build family financial strength, and their children are able to succeed. House Bill 3082 supports family housing stability. It revises the statute to provide another local option under which jurisdictions can choose to exempt nonprofit housing from property taxes. This exemption provides stability for families with low incomes whose abilities rise slightly during their tenancy. It provides them a smooth transition rather than a cliff as they work toward homeownership or private market housing. Let me give you a quick example, because this bill, as Representative Frederick mentioned, it is a little bit confusing about what it actually does. When people are in affordable housing, they're able to get tax exemption under the bill, ORS 307-540. And the way it works right now, in particular with PCRI's properties, many of them are single-family homes. So if a person's income rises above 61%, suddenly that single-family home has to bear the full burden of the property taxes. In the city of Portland, that could be up to $3,000, $4,000 a year. They can't actually pass that burden on to the families in the homes, and so right now the organization has to absorb that cost. It's really not a sustainable model. And so if they do say, well, you have to move now because now your income is above 61%, well, they're not ready at 61% to move into market rate housing or into homeownership at all. And so what this bill does is it actually allows those tenants to stay in that housing up until 80% of MFI, when at that time they're actually more able to move into either market rate rental housing or home ownership. So that's really what this is ultimately trying to do, is to keep people from being harmed by being upwardly mobile in their income. So that's really the basic piece that we're trying to accomplish here. So it really, in short, it really creates an additional option for local jurisdictions to provide nonprofit housing residents with a property tax exemption that's consistent with that jurisdiction's affordable housing goals. I want to point out that this doesn't change it for the state. It only allows local jurisdictions to decide whether or not they want to allow folks to stay in if their income rises above 60% MFI. And with that, I will stop and pass it on to my my partners here. I do encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good day, Chair and committee members. Thank you. I am Maxine Fitzpatrick, the Executive Director of Portland Community Reinvestment Initiatives, commonly known as PCRI. I'm pleased to be here this afternoon to testify in support of House Bill 3082. I'm also deeply appreciative of Representative Frederick's sponsorship and Senator Shields' co-sponsorship of this bill, and for the nearly unanimous support of your colleagues in the House. Their support of HB 3082 recognizes the importance of homeownership and the effectiveness of programs that PCRI and other community organizations provide to assist families to transition into homeownership, out of poverty, hopefully into homeownership, and long-term sustainability for that family. By adopting this small change to the statute, you will allow local jurisdictions to remove a barrier that currently exists for nonprofits whose residents are ready to move up and out of affordable housing into homeownership. John just described the details and the effect of House Bill 3082. Representative Fredericks did an excellent overview of it as well. I would like to let you know the difference that this bill can make for PCRI households. With over 700 units of affordable housing, PCRI's unique mix of single-family rental homes, small multiplexes, and community apartment provides the last stable opportunities for low-income households to remain in their historic North and Northeast Portland neighborhoods. PCRI rental homes and apartments are woven into the fabric of North and Northeast Portland, and it's a model for eliminating concentrations of poverty. Under the existing rules, if this family, as John indicated, and as Representative Fredericks indicated, if their income goes up 0.5%, 1%, over 60% AMI, suddenly PCRI is taxed with a $4,000 to $5,000 annual property tax liability for that housing. That means if we were to pass that on to the resident, that would be over $300, almost $420 in that range a month rent increase that we would have to pass on to that household. So we can't do that. What we do is we figure out a way to absorb that expense ourselves, and we do that at jeopardy of destabilizing our organization and being able to provide that housing for families in the future. What I'd like to share with you a bit is a couple of residents that we have most recently transitioned to homeownership. One is Ms. Rachel Allen. I remember seeing Ms. Allen the first time, and she was at an opening for one of our rental developments. And she walked around, and at the end of the session, I asked one of the employees, well, who was that lady? Because she wasn't one of the people that I knew and recognized that someone had been invited. She was a resident in Northeast Portland that was living in substandard housing, and the housing wasn't even affordable. Eventually, she became a resident, and when she moved in, the housing that she lived in was at 30% AMI. Over the years, Ms. Allen stabilized her family and eventually raised her income enough so that she could enter into PCRI's homeownership program. She did. She entered into PCRI's homeownership program, eventually became a homeowner, and not only did she encourage her son to eventually become a homeowner going through PCRI's program, her brother as well. And then there's Mr. Joshua LaRose. Mr. LaRose came into a PCRI, and unlike Ms. Allen, he didn't take 12 years to move on to home ownership. He only took two. And after 2 years of working with PCRI counselors, he was able to move on to home ownership. And he noted that no longer did he have to pay housing that really didn't benefit his family. Now he had home ownership opportunity that benefited his family now and into the future. Those are the kind of households that PCRI serves. Those are the kind of stories that we know can happen over and over again. In conclusion, I want to strongly urge your support for House Bill 3082 and commend your work to assure that all Oregonians have access to housing so that they can afford in order to be successful in school, at work, and as community members. They need and will have our support and your support as they transition permanently up and out of poverty. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Val Dalfrey. I'm the Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Washington County. I also serve as board member on the Oregon Opportunity Network and also on the State Housing Council. I speak to you today on behalf of Washington County. Washington County joins other affordable housing advocates and local jurisdictions in support of House Bill 3082, which is an adjustment to current law that is needed to provide local communities flexibility and to make sure families who are making progress towards housing stability can continue on that successful pathway. In Washington County, we believe that families and children prosper in life, at work, and at school when they can access the stability of a home. Washington County in 2010 enabled the state's nonprofit affordable housing tax exemption by ordinance to increase the availability of stable, affordable housing for low-income families and children. While this exemption has been successful in supporting affordable housing development in Washington County, the income limits for low-income households living in these properties may cause challenges for families who are working hard to improve their earned incomes. As you have heard, if a household increases their income by just $1 above the 60% area median income, this increase alone can endanger the property's tax exemption. In some cases, families who are experiencing success in moving towards self-sufficiency could actually be displaced from their affordable housing units, in essence, penalizing them for working hard to succeed in life by forcing them to compete in the high-cost private housing market, where their low income places them at a great disadvantage in the likely loss of family housing stability. Washington County is a growing and prosperous county, but the population growth exceeds the housing supply. And with a vacancy rate of about 2%, there are few housing options affordable for low-income households. Washington County strongly supports the option to allow families living in affordable housing to increase their incomes up to 80% area median income without endangering the affordability of their current units. We believe this option will help working families to continue their progress toward self-sufficiency by allowing these families to remain stably housed as their income increases. As you have heard, House Bill 3082 provides an important tool for local jurisdictions in their efforts to support increased housing opportunity. We strongly urge the committee to support House Bill 3082. Thank you very much for your cooperation.
Thank you very much. Any brief questions for this panel? We're pretty far behind time at this point. No? All right. Thank you, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate District 22. I just wanted to state briefly on the record that I fully support House Bill 3082 and would urge your support as well. Also want to call to attention that they have a broad coalition supporting this, and I think in OLIS you should have received testimony from Lincoln County as well as the Urban League and Cully Living Cully Neighborhood Partners. This bill, House Bill 3082, will give us the flexibility to make sure that individuals and families have a soft landing and aren't forced out of affordable housing before they're able to find replacement housing. It also helps to eliminate the benefit cliff that serves as a disincentive for people to find work for fear that they would lose their housing. I think it's a balanced, common sense reform that will help provide a path to success for our low-income community members. Thank you for your consideration of House Bill 3082, and again, I urge your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions for Senator Shields? Seeing none, is there anybody else that needs to be heard on House Bill 3082? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3082, and I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 3082. I can't do anything without you.
Caught me off guard.
I try.
Burn your pants.
That's right. Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 3082 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 3082 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I just want to thank Representative Frederick and Senator Shields for bringing this bill. It's very important, and thank you for sharing the stories of the people that this will impact. I really appreciate it.
Senator Shields carries, right?
And Senator Shields, you'll carry?
Sir?
Will you carry the bill?
Sure.
Great. We're going to vote on it. I think it has a good chance of passing. Thanks. All right, is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. The bill goes to the floor. Senator Shields will carry. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3082 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2414. Kathy Prouty.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2414 allows the Department of Human Services to add genetic siblings of adoptees to the voluntary adoption search registry. It defines rules for addition of and search for minor siblings on the registry, allows sharing certain types of information electronically. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelzer, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Prouty. I'm the Child Permanency Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, Child Welfare Division, and I'm here to testify today on behalf of House Bill 2414. The Office of Child Welfare operates the Mandatory Adoption Search and Registry Program, and first of all, the search program is a program by which a qualified user can make a request to the department to seek out another qualified user. So, for example, an adult adoptee as a qualified user can contact the search and registry program and ask to search for, let's say, a birth father. The department commences a search, and if they find the birth father, asks the birth father if they would allow their identifying information to be shared. And if the answer is yes, then the department puts those two parties together. If the answer is no, then that information remains confidential. So the registry program is similar, but the registry program allows eligible persons to re-register so that if one party seeks the other party, we already have that identifying information on file and we can put the two parties together. We already have that permission. So since operating these programs, the department has identified barriers for certain individuals to use the program. Specifically, that would be minor adoptees, siblings of minor adoptees, and then the descendants of deceased registry users. So the first thing this bill does, it adds adoptive parents of minor adoptees to be able to register their adopted children for potential contact with other qualified registers. And second, right now, Oregon statute only allows siblings separated by adoption to search for one another if their birth parent has registered, if all of the siblings have reached the age of 18, and if the birth parent approves contact. And this bill would allow for the adoptive parent of a minor adoptee and the siblings to register for one another regardless of the birth parent's status with the registry. And we believe that that would be a positive change. We believe that siblings that are separated by adoption should be afforded a better opportunity to search for and connect with one another, and this bill would allow that to happen. And then third, current statute places limits on individuals who can use the search and registry program when a party to the registry is deceased. And only the adoptive parents of a deceased adoptee and then the parents or adult sibling of a birth parent can use the registry. So it really limits the descendants of adoptees or the descendants of birth parents to be able to use the search and registry program to find their birth relatives if the original registrants have died. And so this would be an opportunity for descendants and more persons to use the registry to seek out their birth families. And then this bill also fixes a couple of other things. There was an unforeseen barrier associated with the passage of Senate Bill 623. That's the Senate bill that opened adoption records when adult adoptees become 18. And what happened is many of those adult adoptees didn't know which county their cases finalized in, and so they couldn't go and search for their court record. And the department did not have the authority to give them any of that information because the record remained sealed. So this would allow the department to share the county of origin where an adoption finalized so that adult adoptees and birth parents can have access to their records that they now have access to. And finally, the bill cleans up some inconsistent language regarding who can use the search service versus the mutual consent registry, and then it removes the requirement that when conducting a search, it needs to happen in person, and that the counseling that's connected with this service. Today, the statute says it needs to be provided by a social worker, and we also don't think that's necessary. So In summary, we believe that expanding the mandatory adoption search and registry program would be a positive change for families and adoptees.
So what does that look like when you contact somebody? Who makes that contact and what do you say?
Madam Chair, the department actually contracts the service out. So we have contracts with persons who do the search, and they will contact someone who is either registered or someone who they have found during a search, and they will have a conversation with them that somebody is looking for them and provide the information as to who that is and provide some counseling about what that means, and then the party has the decision to say yes or no at that point.
So hypothetically, if there was a 15-year-old that really wanted to meet their birth parents and the adoptive parents had that contact information, but could they then register that child and then DHS would contract with somebody to contact that birth parent directly and say, your 15-year-old biological child is trying to find you. Would you be willing to meet with her?
Madam Chair, that is correct. If the adoptee is a minor, then the adoptive parent has to make that decision, and the adoptive parent can contact the registry. If the birth parent has already registered, then we can put the two parties together. If the birth parent hasn't registered, then we would search for that birth parent and then ask for whether they are willing to make that contact or not.
And so if the adoptive family had the contact information for the birth or had that information, it's not just a matter of that information. DHS would proactively go to that birth parent, have a conversation with them, proactively saying, this child wants to connect with you. Can they?
Well, Madam Chair, if I understand your question, there are a number of open adoptions where the adoptive parent and the birth parent already know who each other is, and they can contact each other outside of the department as often or as little as they want. It's only if they don't have that identifying information or don't know where the other person is that they would use the registry. They don't have to go through the department if they already have an open adoption and they have identifying information about each other.
Let me ask the question a different way. I think there's people that have closed adoptions where people know who people are, but it hasn't been contact in a very, very long time, and kids that want to find them. I guess the question is, do you just go out and get the information, put it back in the registry, or do you proactively go and ask that birth parent, hey, your biological child is looking for you. They would like to make contact with you. May we provide your most recent telephone number? Expect a telephone call.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that is correct. We would proactively go and search for that person, and then with their permission, we would provide identifying information to each other.
Okay.
Correct.
And then when that information is provided back to the person that initiated the registry, they could then assume from that it wouldn't be a bad experience when they would contact, they wouldn't be told, I don't want to hear from you. So the person is giving permission. If the child goes to the registry and says that they want to have that connection, and then you go to the birth parent provides the information. The child, the minor child, then makes a phone call to this person. Can we be confident that minor child is not going to be rejected when they make that telephone call?
Madam Chair, I don't know that I could say that. The department doesn't act as a mediator at all when that contact happens. We simply provide the identifying information to one another. So we wouldn't have any way to know how that first contact commences or how positive or negative, for that matter, that may be.
But when the birth parent gives the information, they would know that would be for the purpose of the child contacting them. So if they did not want to be found or contacted, they could just say no.
That is correct.
Okay. Other questions? And how many have you had siblings, minor children? How frequently are you getting these requests that you don't have the authority to?
Madam Chair, I My policy analyst who runs this program, it happens enough that we wanted the change in this bill because right now they have to wait until they're adults. I can't give you an exact number, but it's frequent enough that we thought it was important to change the law.
And do you have a range? Is it a couple times a month or a few times a year? And is it more children looking for birth parents looking for children, siblings?
Madam Chair, it's all of the above. It's siblings looking for each other. It's siblings looking for their birth parents. Sometimes they'll contact the registry. In the modern day of social media, a lot of children go out and search for their parents on their own and actually find them. So I can give you some statistics on the use of the registry if you would like that.
I think that would be helpful before we move the bill. And I guess one other question. So I think that social media is part of where you end up with a closed adoption where people have that contact information. Is there a way for that for the registry or for DHS? I can just imagine circumstances where a person has made a decision to make an adoption plan for their child, and they have kept that very secret from the people around them. And even though now I think open adoptions are much more common, you have kids, middle schoolers, high schoolers, that are able to use social media to track down their birth parents, and maybe without even talking to their parents, try to make that contact. Is there a way to use that registry so that those children can be supported in what could end up being an emotionally devastating situation for them if they end up contacting someone that doesn't want to be contacted and doesn't be found, and at the same time respecting the privacy of that birth parent whose life might be devastated if they didn't want to be found and they have children or a spouse or parents or whoever that don't know this part of their story? Do you understand the...
I do, and Madam Chair, I think that's part of the purpose behind the bill, that we really want the adoptive parents to be the ones that are making the decisions and supporting the children and making sure that it's the right time for them to find a sibling or a parent. At this point, we're not suggesting that a minor be allowed to use the registry on their own, just for some of the reasons that you just said. But remember, with the passage of Senate Bill 623, as soon as that adoptee reaches the age of 18, they now have access to their entire adoptive record minus the home study, as does a birth parent. So that bill, that particular change in the law took effect January of 2014. And so there are now birth parents and adult adoptees who have all of their identifying information about each other at age 18 at their disposal. And that's a policy decision that Oregon made during the last large session. So we have really changed adoption fairly dramatically in this state.
And have you had any contact from birth parents who have been contacted that never expected to be contacted?
Madam Chair, I don't know if my policy analyst who runs this program has had contact or not.
Great. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Clearly, I have a lot of questions about this.
Thank you very, very much.
And can you get that information to us soon, and we'll reschedule this for a work session?
Absolutely.
Really soon. Thank you very much. All right. All right, now we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2414, open up a public hearing on House Bill 2415.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2415A allows the Department of Human Services or the Oregon Health Authority to request financial institutions to release specified information regarding deposit accounts held by deceased persons, creates an exception to prohibited release of private financial records, has no revenue impact, a fiscal statement as issued, has no subsequent referral.
We've got Rick Mills.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Rick Mills. I'm a policy analyst for the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery, Department of Human Services, and we're here today to speak in support of HB 2415A. We in our estate recovery program, as you're probably aware, when an individual passes away and receives certain types of public benefits, typically Medicaid, that individual's estate may be required to reimburse the state some or all of the benefits that that individual received. We currently have legal authority to go straight to financial institutions where that individual had a bank account and request those funds be disbursed to us. And we estimate that we recover about $2 to $3 million a year from those bank accounts. However, we think we can do better. So we reached out to the Oregon Bankers Association and the Northwest Credit Union Association. Both organizations were very responsive and very helpful in helping to draft the bill that you have before you today. And in real quick nutshell, what this bill does is it allows us to request additional specifically enumerated information from the financial institutions, which will help us to better identify funds that are unaccounted for and then do a cost-benefit analysis before we incur significant DOJ expense trying to recover those funds. With that, I'm going to cut off here and try to answer any questions you may have regarding this bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? I would note for the record that I got an email earlier today from Pam Levitt of the Credit Union Association. She's not able to be here this afternoon, but she expressed her support of the bill. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, is there anybody else that wants to talk about this bill? Nope. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2415 and open a work session on House Bill 2415.
Chair Gilster, I move House Bill 2415A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2415A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Who would love to carry this bill? Senator Olson would love to carry this bill. Thank you, Senator Olson.
I didn't say that.
I could see it on your face. Closing the work session on House Bill 2415A and opening a public hearing on House Bill 2442A.
That's right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2442A replaces the existing State Housing Council with the Oregon Housing Stability Council. It abolishes Advisory Committee on Energy and Community Development and Senate Advisory Board and transfers that authority to the new council, abolishes Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness and transfers responsibility to the new council, authorizes the new council to provide Oregon Housing and Community Services with financial and budgetary oversight, and transfers responsibility for Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force to the Department of Human Services and defines the funding mechanism. Also clarifies this name change and usages. This has to do with the Housing Community Services restructuring and transformation. There is an A5 amendment before the committee that makes a minor correction permitting the Community Action Partnerships of Oregon to advise Oregon Housing Community Services and the new council, removing language that says they have to do that in conjunction with. There's no revenue impact on the A5. There's a minimal fiscal on the A5. There's no subsequent referral.
Thank you very much. We've got Margaret Van Vliet, Aubrey Dixon, John Miller, and Patty Whitney Wise. If we could grab an extra chair. Thank you. Thank you for being patient.
Of course. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. We're glad to be here to talk about this important bill. It's important to the policy and governance oversight of my agency. This bill is a result of a lot of work we've done over the last couple of years to really take a close look at service delivery, the way we make decisions, our fiscal sort of business plan, and a whole host of other issues. It was a very exhaustive process. It involved lots of stakeholders and the many advisory bodies that currently advise my agency on different streams of funding in different policy areas. And so the consensus that came out of that process was that we really need to streamline policy and governance and elevate what is now the Housing Council, rename it, give it a kind of refreshed charter. And so that's really what this bill does. Today, the Housing Council, and you'll hear from our chair in a minute, has 7 members. Primarily, their role is, I would say, fiduciary. They approve grants and loans over certain dollar amounts for only certain streams of funding, not for all streams of funding. And so we have really worked hard to think about what does the state need in terms of strong housing policy and how could we move to that different place. And so 2442, again, represents consensus recommendations after working with our wide array of partners. You'll hear from a couple of them today. It creates this overarching policy body, adds some responsibilities, and adds two members. It does not make significant changes to the role of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which has its own advisory function with respect to the department's programs. It does some cleanup and adds a few areas of oversight and advice to that body. Importantly, this bill also removes limitations on some existing limitations on what the Housing Stability Council can comment on in regard to our budget, and it adds a little more clarity and authority around providing policy direction and a financial plan. It asks the Housing Stability Council to develop policies to address geographic and racial disparities and policies to help ensure funds meet a variety of state objectives. It also requests that the governor, in appointing members, give consideration to geographic distribution and a range of expertise in housing programs and services to people in poverty. It makes changes to several advisory bodies. It removes the Advisory Committee on Energy. And this has historically performed a function related to the fact that my agency administers weatherization and energy assistance programs, some of which are funded by public purpose charge and ratepayer funds. It's important that we have a close connection to the utilities through which those funds flow. And so while we're removing that Advisory Committee on Energy, I want to be very clear that we intend to continue to work closely with them as we go forward to make sure that we're accountable to them, and we're actually anticipating that they will be set up something as a subcommittee, if you will, to the Housing Council. What we want to move away from is having different advisory bodies advise on particular streams of funds and instead have an overarching full look. The bill also removes the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness, but gives those responsibilities to the Housing Stability Council and to the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. It transfers the Hunger Task Force to DHS and makes minor changes to the statutes regarding hunger, including updating the name of the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And it removes a couple of obsolete advisory bodies, mostly the Community Development Incentive Advisory Body, Advisory Board, and any of the relevant functions that group did will be assumed by the Housing Stability Council. Really glad to be at this point. Really glad to have the support of the partners. The A5 amendments, as you've heard, just fix a very small error. So with that, I'll turn it over to my Housing Council Chair, Aubrey Dixon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Aubrey Dixon, and as Margaret indicated, I am the current chair of the Oregon State Housing Council. I also work for KeyBank. I'm a senior relationship manager in our community development banking group. I have served on the Housing Council since June of 2012 and was appointed and confirmed chair in September of 2014 and presided over my first meeting in November. I joined the Housing Council mainly for two reasons. First, as a practitioner in the affordable housing industry, I wanted the opportunity to play a greater role in shaping the direction of affordable housing finance by using my expertise to help address and provide solutions for the lack of affordable housing and the struggle to end homelessness in the state of Oregon. And secondly, probably more importantly, at least to me, I'm a first-generation Oregonian that happens to be a product of the very housing that Oregon Housing has worked hard to provide and preserve throughout the state of Oregon. Had it not been for federal, state, and local programs that assist low-income families to obtain safe, decent, and affordable housing, my single mother of two would not have been able to afford a decent house, place to call home. And I would not be sitting before you today. It is because of my passion, conviction, and personal testimony for housing choice and opportunity, the fact that I am an example of what this very housing can provide, I can credibly rebut the negative stigma and perception about not only affordable housing developments, but the people that reside in the units. It is my eternal belief the work that the Housing Council and Oregon Housing does gives low-income individuals and families hope and faith that will give with a hand up, not a hand out, they can succeed. And it all starts with a quality place that they can call home. This is why the work of the Housing Council is vitally important. The council is actively working to understand both its current and proposed responsibilities, as well as to work more collaboratively with other advisory bodies, such as the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, better known as CAPO. We recently had a joint Housing Council and CAPO meeting in January to discuss the state of homelessness in Oregon and ask questions that begin to shape and formalize ideas for the application of former Governor Kitzhaber's proposed $100 million homeless families initiative that has been supported by Governor Brown. There are plans to hold several more of these joint meetings, the next one being June 5th. This leads me to the purpose of why we are here today, and that is to testify in support of House Bill 2442. The goal of HB 2442 is to give the council, and if passed, newly named the Housing Stability Council, greater authority and agency oversight, particularly as it pertains to providing policy directions across all agency programs and play a more active role in fiscal management by overseeing the financial budgeting process, as well as greater levels of engagement in the issues so pressing across all areas of the state. The name change is symbolic. It is a better representation of the overarching mission and vision of both Oregon Housing and Housing Council. It is not just provide housing, but housing stability, which is not possible without the wraparound services provided by service organizations such as the community action agencies, coordinated care organizations, and other local agencies. For these programs that allow individuals and families to improve their physical, social, and financial well-being in alignment with the Healthy People program area, with the goal of progression through the housing continuum, from affordable housing to market rate, and hopefully eventually to home ownership. The proposed changes will also inject a spirit of collaboration and thrive in the collective efforts across state government to achieve the interconnected policy objectives and state priorities. There are many issues posing challenges in the development of affordable housing throughout many communities, such as the lack of supply, high land and acquisition costs, the increasing cost of building materials that are driving up the cost of construction, and as we are all keenly aware, the lack of soft funding to help reduce project debt, in effect subsidizing rents by making projects affordable to very low and extremely low-income households. These are but a snapshot of some of the issues that Oregon Housing, Housing Council, CAPO, and others such as Oregon Opportunity Network grapple with, necessitating greater efforts to work together alongside regional solutions teams to brainstorm creative solutions to eradicate poverty and end homelessness. To this end, in closing, the council believes the proposed changes will lead us to a more effective and engaged council, better oversight and direction for the agency, and more engagement with partners. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you have done a fantastic job laying it out. I'm going to encourage the two of you to be somewhat brief. We've got an information hearing, and I'm worried that we're going to run out of time for it.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, absolutely, I feel I owe you some time from my last time up here. So I'm John Miller, Executive Director of Oregon Opportunity Network. Oregon On is a statewide association of about 150 organizations that are all part of delivering affordable housing in the state. We worked closely with OHCS over the last year and a half through their transformation, and then also in the last six or nine months on this particular bill. I'm just here to give our full support for this bill. It absolutely accomplishes the things that we were hoping for through the transformation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee, Patty Whitney Wise with Partners for Hunger Free Oregon and staff to the Oregon Hunger Task Force. We've appreciated our years under Oregon Housing and Community Services, and we look forward to working with the Department of Human Services. Coincidentally, USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture Western Region, is coming up in another week to discuss with the Department of Human Services how they can more fully engage around eliminating food insecurity in the state, and we will be part of that conversation. So the shift over comes at a very timely moment to really focus in with the department on those issues. We support the bill. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you all so much. Are there questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all so much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2442A and open up a work session on House Bill 2442A.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the Dash A5 amendment dated 4/27/2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the Dash A5 amendments dated 4/27/2015. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 2442A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2442A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I think Michael Dimmer should carry.
I was thinking the same thing. Is there any objection to the bill, not to Senator Dimmer carrying the bill? Seeing.
Well, if he's going to carry, I'll vote for it.
So. All right. So just to be clear, is there any objection to the bill?
No.
Okay. So the motion passes. Senator Dimbrough, I believe you have been nominated and elected to carry the bill.
Since I have been nominated, Madam Chair, I shall serve.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2442A and open up the informational meeting on Oregon's mental health system. Invite up Pam Martin, please.
Thank you so much, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. And for the record, my name is Pam Martin, and I'm the director of the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to talk about access to mental health and substance abuse services in Oregon. So the title of my discussion is No Wrong Door, and I'll be talking about the many different times and the ways that people enter the behavioral health system. But I want to say from the outset that this is in no way exhaustive, because people enter the system in many, many different ways. So the first slide was the information on the first slide was compiled from the Measurement and Outcomes Tracking System and is based on 73,657 unique individuals who engaged in treatment in 2014. And the graph shows the top 8 referral sources for people in the system. 25% were, and this is for mental health referrals, 25% of people were referred by a health professional, for example, a primary care physician. 23% were self-referred, where people noticed a problem themselves and referred themselves. 15% were referred by a family member or a friend. And this shows the same referral paths to community treatment for people with substance use disorder referrals. The referral pattern is slightly different in that only 5% were referred by a health professional versus 25% for mental health. 27% of people referred themselves and 15% were referred by family members. So in an ideal behavioral health care system, there would be no wrong doors. There would be many ways to access a health care system, and every door would eventually lead to the right care at the right time. The urgency of the problem often determines which of these three general doors people go through to access care. The American College of Emergency Room Physicians defines an emergency service this way. An emergency service is any health care service provided to evaluate and or treat any medical condition such that a prudent layperson possessing an average knowledge of medicine and health believes that immediate, unscheduled medical care is required. And I think this holds for behavioral health. People often end up going through the emergent or emergency door when experiencing symptoms of psychosis or when they're acting in a way that's dangerous to themselves or to other people. So, for example, I call a crisis line because I feel out of control and depressed and I have a gun at my home. Or I'm 86 years old and my family brings me to the emergency room because I'm confused and I have a UTI. Or I'm scared because I almost overdosed on OxyContin, or I'm off my meds and I'm hearing voices telling me to hurt myself. Those would be the kind of situations where people would seek emergent care. Urgent care is in physical medicine is when people have sprains or strains, sore throats, sinus or ear infections. In the behavioral health world, these events that are urgent might be getting arrested or convicted of a DUI or having symptoms that can be managed outside of a hospital. And the routine door is where most people receive their outpatient services. So it's very common when you call a health line at all, you'll hear somebody say, if this is emergency, hang up and call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room. And that happens. And over a 1 year period, about 14,000 emergency department visits were made by adults on Medicaid with a mental health emergency. Since the expansion of Medicaid, these numbers have been going up, but they're actually a lower rate per 1,000 people. People also call crisis lines. And we have a number of crisis lines in Oregon. One of them is Lines for Life. Lines for Life has specialized lines for suicide, for alcohol and drugs. There's a military helpline and also a youth line. And crisis calls into crisis lines in Oregon over a 1 year period were 158,000 calls, or about 13,000 calls a month going into one of the county crisis lines or into Lines for Life. We also have mobile crisis units. In other words, somebody calls 911 or gets in touch with the police in some other way, and an on-site treatment is provided increasingly in Oregon by a pair of practitioners, one law enforcement person and one from the behavioral health world. So there are some exemplary programs. One is in Marion County. Yamhill County has a great program as well. The teams of multidisciplinary teams. We funded 12 community mental health programs serving 18 counties, but actually there are 21 counties that have some kind of mobile crisis. In Hood River, it's called the Accelerated Community Crisis and Engagement Support Services, and in Lane County, it's called CAHOOTS, which is Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets. So this is another emergent door. We also, I want to say before we move on to urgent, we also have community detoxification services for people with immediate and short-term clinical support for acute physical symptoms associated with alcohol or drug withdrawal, and that's 24-hour medically supervised care, and about, I'd say 5,000 people receive that service. That was another door that people walk through. And, of course, we have 14 acute psychiatric care facilities in the state. And in 2014, about 7,500 people walked through that door and were admitted to acute psychiatric care. So in all that urgent, that emergent door, for the documentation around the Medicaid population that we, to the extent that we have it, show that there were about 200,000 contacts with some kind of emergency system. So with the urgent door, could be something like this. I got arrested for breaking and entering a garage. I'm homeless. I'm looking for food and a place to stay, and I don't have any ID. Or somebody who says, I just need a place away from my family for a couple of days to get myself together. Or I got referred to a mental health court. Or I'm 18 and I'm hearing voices telling me I'm a bad person and I'm scared. So the reason we call these urgent is because it's very serious situations, but the safety of the person is not immediately in danger. So one way that people go through that door is by getting arrested. And there are now 13 programs in 15 counties so that that serve people with mental illness who become arrested. The jail diversion programs served about 1,400 people last year. They're growing. As soon as somebody is recognized as having a mental illness, there's inreach into the jail, and efforts are made to get people out quickly and to get them into care. Or if they have to stay in jail, then it's the provision of services. It is there. Another door is arrest for DUI, and last year, about 20,000 people in Oregon were arrested, but about 14,000 people in this group went into substance disorder treatment, and 70% of them completed treatment. So although that's not a great door to walk through, it led to a lot of people receiving treatment and successfully completing it. Mental health courts is another way when people are arrested, but they are referred to the 13 mental health courts that are in the state. There was a recent survey that was done by NAMI showing where the mental health courts are, and there are also two municipal courts. Another place that people go, let's do that, is on probation and parole. I actually don't have information about how many people in that category are receiving behavioral health, mental health services, but I know that there are a number of people who are. We also have crisis beds. They're located in the community, in apartments and private homes and unlicensed facilities, and there are crisis stabilization beds and subacute beds as well. And something over 3,000 people were able to access those services in a year's time. We have walk-in clinics as well. And then I want to talk just for a moment about the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Providers, AOCMHP, and Cheryl Ramirez, who have been spearheading the mental health first aid work that's in Oregon. So that is what that creates is more doors. It's a program that's mental health to mental health as CPR is. It's what it does is it has lay people who attend a very robust program and learn a lot about mental health. It reduces the stigma of mental health. It helps people understand what's happening with their neighbors and their kids. And the list of people who have been trained in mental health first aid is just remarkable. School staff, law enforcement officers, Bikers Against Child Abuse, public safety people, vets, people in churches, higher education. So what this provides is just more places for people to walk through a door, to meet with somebody who's a neighbor, a friend, a pastor, who is not frightened by what they're saying and can help get them into services.
How many people have you trained?
6,000 people throughout the state so far. And that's just in the last last couple of years.
And is it statewide?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It'd be nice to know, because it's the rural areas that really need to have mental health trained professionals, and they don't always get the licensed ones. And I was just wondering, you don't have a breakdown of where these people are?
I do. I have a list that we can send to you.
Thank you.
I have the list and some of the audiences, the number of, they've had 136 classes for people, and I know they're working very hard to provide training for trainers so we can even have more classes.
And does that number include the trainings that are being done by Samaritan? And so I know there's another mental health first aid training focused on youth in Corvallis next week, and our CCO and the Samaritan Health Foundation have been paying for a number of these in Lynn Benton and Lincoln counties?
No, it doesn't. So there are even more than 6,000. Yeah.
Madam Chair, and so who pays for these, and how extensive is the training for it?
Well, the training is pretty complete. For it's a nationally recognized evidence-based practice. There's the expense is really for to train the instructors, and for the Association of Oregon Community Health Programs, the Oregon Health Authority has provided funding for that. When the actual training, really, the booklets cost like $25, and you have to have a place for people to come, and they have to spend, I think, about 3 days, 3 to 4 days on the training.
Thank you.
So we'll get that complete list, and as I said, I don't have information as to every single thing, but that's really good to know that there's more training going on.
So I think that leads to another question that I have. When we look at our mental health system, it's a combination of what's publicly available and publicly financed, and what's available through the community, through private pay, through commercial insurance. Does the health authority have any role or responsibility around coordination and looking at that total landscape of the entire mental health system in the state, or is your work more narrowly tailored to that is publicly paid for and delivered?
So, Chair Gelsler and members of the committee, it's a really excellent question, and I think that I think that the Oregon Health Authority is responsible for policy that is set around a number of things that is statewide, and I think that we are starting to gather information through sources such as All Pay or All Claims to look at, say, emergency room usage. We don't have information on, say, the number of people who are accessing outpatient services, but I think that those are things that we should think about. So, for example, about half of the people who are at the Oregon State Hospitals have Medicaid, which means the half do not. So that we do have a responsibility to look at the entire system. Yeah. So there are many other doors. I mean, another program that's really excellent is the ESA program, Early Assessment and Support Alliance. So rather than what that program does is get referrals from families and friends and schools to bring kids in who are having the first symptoms of psychosis, and it keeps kids in school, keeps their families informed, so that they have found that kids who have been in that program for, say, 6 months don't have to, they have a 37% decrease in hospitalizations. So going in the right door at the right time can reduce reliance on other parts of the system that are not only more expensive but much more disruptive for kids and families. So there is a routine door as well, and so I call my health plan for advice, and a nurse says I really should see my doctor for insomnia, or my wife is all over me because I drink too much on the weekends, or my kiddo is struggling with ADHD and he gets some counseling at school but I think he needs more, and my doctor helps me with my diabetes and with my depression. And so a number of people use nurse health lines, and this is something that's provided by all health plans, because it's very, very effective. But I just want to say that routine is not always routine. For example, NAMI takes about, NAMI Central and around the state, takes about 4,000 calls a year to what is their helpline, but they very often will get crisis calls as well. So people are going in and out of all these doors. So you may call somebody for advice, and they might tell you you need to get to the emergency department now. but people, it's another avenue for people. The primary care team is becoming increasingly important. Most of the 7-Eleven medications, the psychotropic medications, are probably prescribed by primary care teams, and 11.3% of all Medicaid members in the third quarter of 2014 were receiving at least one psychotropic medication. So that's 113,000 prescriptions. The other thing that's happening at the PCP office increasingly is screening. Adolescent depression screening, screening for alcohol and drug use with the screening brief intervention referral and treatment model, and other screening mechanisms like the PHQ questions. So the primary care team is absolutely essential. And another place where people are and kids are schools. These doors should be easy to find. And we have school-based centers in 68 schools in Oregon. And we're able to increase in the last couple of years the number of school-based health centers that have mental health services, and when there were not a school-based health center in the school, to add mental health coordinators to the mix. And about 6,000 kids received services, kids who are in Medicaid who we track, receive these kinds of services. And of course, a huge number of people walk into urgent care clinics. They may spontaneously recognize a problem, make an appointment to see someone, contact a provider, contact places like NAMI, or they do an online search, which I'm going to mention more about in a moment, or they talk to other advocacy groups. And as I mentioned, NAMI had about 4,000 calls last year, and all mental health outpatient services for children and adults in a year, these again are people on Medicaid, were about 120,000 people were accessing services. An additional 47,000 people accessed substance abuse services, and there were another 6,000 people through schools. So outpatient services were administered, received by about 177,000 people. Now, we don't know if all the people who are getting medication are also getting services. So those could be two different doors. And I was also asked to talk about the major barriers to accessing these doors. And increasingly, they are workforce issues. Now, there's some great work going on with training police officers and other law enforcement personnel with crisis intervention training, CIT, and mental health first aid is a wonderful addition. But in the report to Congress on the nation's substance abuse and mental health workforce in January of 2013, the workforce shortage causes were discussed. One, of course, is the increase in the number of people eligible for services. Another is that there is a parity now, so that more people are entitled to mental health services. As more screenings are done in primary care settings for depression, alcohol, drugs, and other problems, there'll be more people referred to services. And we have an aging workforce. Psychologists have a median age of 50, and 46% of all psychiatrists in the United States are over 65 years old. So we have an aging workforce and problems with compensation as well. And just briefly, the workforce is not evenly distributed. 55% of U.S. counties are rural and frontier, and they have no practicing psychiatrist, psychologist, or social worker. And as we integrate services with behavioral health and primary care, a lot of mental health people are not trained in the documentation or are trained in the new skills that are needed for that setting, and we're not yet where we need to be with using evidence-based practices. So we have about, again, what I could document from the data I have right now, about 200,000 people walking through this door, about 22,000 people walking through that door, and about 177,000 walking through that door with some
Could you go back and do those numbers one more time?
Yes. 200,000 people, if we count.
Emergent?
Yeah, emergent. 22,000 through the urgent. And we have 177,000 people documented to have received outpatient services. And we have another 113,000 people who are receiving psychotropic medications. And we just talked today about crosswalking that group and finding out if how many people receiving psychotropic medications are also being referred.
So those numbers really seem to point to the problem that we have. If you have more people going through the emergent door than you have through the urgent and routine door combined, that's probably a problem.
Well, I, Senator Gelser, members of the committee, I am including people who called crisis lines. So,
okay.
And
they're not unduplicated.
Chair,
yes.
Under where are you including the crisis line?
Under emergent.
In emergent.
Yeah.
So when you say 200,000 people, is that 200,000 individual people or is that 200,000 contacts?
My understanding is that's 200,000 contacts for crisis lines, but for the data that we have for people going into acute care hospitals and some of those levels of care, those are individuals.
So the number 200,000 is not necessarily 200,000 bodies. That's some bodies.
Correct.
Some.
Correct.
And then is there a way to get that just so the data is a little bit more comparable? Because there might be multiple, a person might make multiple calls to a crisis line, only go through the routine door one time, and is it counted if you go to the doctor three times? Is that three times through the door or?
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, I will go back to my health analytics people and help sorting that out.
That'd be great. Right. Thank you.
And I've not even mentioned the DHS door. I mean, there are many, many other ways that people get referred. Just briefly, we're missing.
Right. But Madam Chair, just sort of in the big picture,
yeah.
Is it your sense that part of the challenge that we face is too many people are waiting too long to get service and are accessing the emergent? Our goal should be to try to move more people down to the routine to make that easier and more available?
Yes, Chair Gelser and Senator Dembrough, absolutely. That is one of the goals, to reduce hospitalizations and to make sure that people get their services in the community. So I just did want to just mention that another major source of health information, as you all know, is the internet. And I Googled mental illness and got 234 million hits. And I Googled substance abuse and got 51 million. So something else we need to think about carefully as we go forward is to understand that how people are using the internet to inform themselves about health. And the Pew Research Center for the Internet Science and Technology has published a study about this that I don't think there's time to go into a lot, but people are searching for health information and in many cases then partnering with their care team, which is great, but it's new territory for everyone. I just wanted to show you that as part of the work we're doing, we're trying to very carefully catalog the services that all these doors, we're trying to do an inventory of all the doors, the formal doors anyway, that exist. So, and we're trying to literally map this out. So, for example, in Douglas County, we're at this point able to we're looking at the county name, and this is not what I thought it was. We're looking at penetration rates, and then we have other, we have for each county, the number of, the poverty rate, the number of kids who are predicted to have serious emotional distress, et cetera, et cetera. Number of civil commitments, and then also we have, well, this is wrong. So we're gathering up information, individual information about counties, and we're also doing a an inventory. So we have another map where you can click on the counties, and it shows you exactly how many outpatient services, whether it's a psychiatric center, there's mobile crisis, and a number of those things.
Well, like, like in Douglas County, I mean, Robin Henderson is finding such a problem because they lack workforce, and especially she's focusing on CCOs in trying to beef up that system in Douglas County. But I'm not seeing the workforce shortage. I mean, you don't you're not following that then in your on that, because that to me is key. I want to know how many providers are in each area, where the workforce shortage is.
So I've just been showed how to do this.
Okay.
Thank you. And for Lane, for example, it shows the number of community treatment programs and just the configuration of it. Now what we're doing is we're drilling down into this, and we will get the actual capability of each program eventually, and whether or not and how many providers are there. We'll be working on that.
Great. Any other questions for Pam? Thank you so much. I know you've put an extraordinary amount of... It appears to be the last slide, but are there more slides?
Thank you.
So are there any other questions for Pam? Am I looking wrong? Are there more slides? Okay. Great. Well, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you, senators, for staying. And with that, I will close the information hearing on mental health, and we are adjourned. And we are adjourned.